Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
With threats to our nation waiting around every corner, adaptability is more important than ever. When conditions change without notice, quick strategic thinking is crucial. And with obstacles consistently impending, determination is essential in overcoming them. It's this willingness, decisiveness, and resilience that sets Marines apart. With our fighting spirit, we don't just fight battles, we win them. Marines are the constant our nation counts on to fight the unknown. And through adaptable problem solving, we do just that. Learn more at Marines.com.
It's a great football team with a lot of moral fiber and a lot of character, and they showed it.
Shout, a Buffalo football podcast, hosted by Matt Perino and Ryan Talbot.
No place else you'd rather be than right here, right now. When it's too tough for them, it's just right.
Presented by Syracuse.com and NYUP.com.
The Bills make me wanna.
What is up, everybody? I feel a little bit out of practice here. It's been 2 weeks to the day since our last show, and I lied to all of you. I said we were going to do at least one down in Florida. I didn't get to one. I was running around doing a bunch of things. I was then going on vacation to Disney World. I'm sure you all know by now. It was our first trip as a family. It was really great. We're going to talk a little bit about that. But then Ryan was going on a trip, and so it's been just this hecticness of 2 weeks. And I was putting together the show today, and I texted Ryan yesterday. He's like, yeah, I have all my stuff in Arizona. He's on vacation, but the Wi-Fi is really bad out here, so I don't know what we're gonna do. And I'm like, you know what, enjoy your vacation, you let me enjoy mine. He was crushing it on the coverage for the past 2 weeks. I'm gonna go to the bullpen, and I'm gonna bring in an ace out of the pen, Joe Biscaglia from The Athletic. What is up, buddy?
Oh, not too much. I gotta throw some shade your way. I've known you all this time now, and you don't even know how to pronounce my last name.
I do, but like I'm looking at the name up on the thing, and I feel like every time I see it, I want to say Skag. I don't know why.
Well, to your point, my nickname growing up was Skags, so it's all kind of there.
And I think it's Tim who calls you sometimes B Skags or something to that extent.
Yeah.
So like it's always floating around in my mind, and you put it up on the thing, but just pronounce it right. Actually,
do you want me to go in and delete the G so that way like we don't run into this again? Just pretend.
Joe Biscaglia. Joe Biscaglia from The Athletic.
Just pretend. I'm
sorry.
It's not there.
No, I apologize.
It's cool. I was very like scarred as a child with all the telemarketers calling and just absolutely butchering my name for years on end. So we're good.
You can find all of his work at The Athletic. It is great work. He's written a bunch of pieces that we're going to talk a little bit about tonight. The Buffalo Beat is the podcast. You're going to want to go check that out. He has a fresh new episode up right now with Elena Getzenberg from ESPN. So you're going to want to go check that out as well. This is the Shout Buffalo Football Podcast. And we are going to get into a lot tonight, Bills related. So stick around. But we got to start with Disney because Joe has been kind of getting me geared up for the Disney trip. He's been a bunch over the years and kind of giving me the do's and don'ts, a lot of different things. And when I got there, I think it's your favorite park. Forgive me if I'm speaking out of turn, but Epcot, I got there and I was waiting to be wowed, and it took a little while. And I tweeted something egregiously, and I said that Epcot was a bit lame. And Joe immediately beelined to the replies, called it out, rightfully so.
Yeah.
And sent me a few notes. Go get a Viking coffee, which absolutely blew my mind. And then some other rides and some other attractions walking through the different countries. And it was awesome. But you had to call me out on my hot take, which turned out to be very lukewarm because I changed it.
Yeah. I mean, I'm glad that you saw the error of your ways, but I'm more interested to see like where it all kind of turned for you, because you got in there, you had like a couple of bad experiences. I don't even know if it was bad. Maybe you're just running on fumes at that point because, you know, Disney's Disney. But like, What was the turning point here? Where did you kind of pick it all up?
There's a guest appearance tonight. My wife, Caitlin. This is now almost 2 year anniversary. You can sit down here. 2 year anniversary of the Shout podcast, and this is her first appearance. Because you're kind of like, I'll come down to your level here for a second.
Oh, thank you.
This is her first appearance on the show, and I had to bring her on today because she had been planning the Disney trip for two years. Like, I'm not even kidding. Like, it's been unbelievable the time and effort that she's put into this. And we get to Epcot, which you screwed everything up.
It's actually accurate. I really did. Well, so what I now, to in my own defense, I am a Disney kid. I've been going to Disney since I was little, but I haven't been to Disney World in about 15 years because we were in Vegas and we did Disneyland twice. Very different. And when I was in Disney World as a teenager, it was different. You had Fast Pass and that was about it. Like, it just wasn't the science that it is now. And it really is such a science. And so I thought like, oh, we're going to rope drop. And I thought I read every blog carefully and I followed all the extremists of it. And I thought I had it all down. And Magic Kingdom the day before, which was our first day, went fairly well. I thought it was good. We stayed through fire. We were there at rope drop. Four resort guests. So we were there at magic hour and then we stayed through fireworks. We did really well. And then Epcot, it just imploded.
Okay. So let me take over here and I'll bring you guys up to speed. We get to Epcot after an absolutely crazy morning. We didn't have breakfast. She's like, we'll eat there. There's nothing open when you first get there because nothing it's open. Basically built for adults. And like they just start drinking. Like you can get any kind of beer you want or alcoholic beverage, but you can't get a decent order of pancakes
or a bagel
anywhere in the place. So I'm just like, I'm not feeling it at the start. We go on. What was the first ride we did? Oh, we went
Spaceship Earth, which is such a classic.
Oh my gosh.
He hated Spaceship Earth.
Like, you know, when they bring out the salad to Michael Scott in the one episode he's ordering and he says, if you bring out the salad some way, I send it back. I wanted to send Epcot back.
He was saying it while we were on Spaceship Earth.
Like, because the ride was so terrible.
He's so dumb.
And so I was like, okay. And then we got to Soarin' and that brought it up a little bit.
What?
Okay. So we went on Soarin'. It was better. Great. It got me emotionally soaring a little bit, I will say. And it got things out of the dumpster.
No, the turning point, there were two turning points that made the whole thing change. The first one was that he got to eat. And so once he got to eat
something. Where did we eat, by the way?
I don't remember. Oh, that Mexican place. And we also had a margarita.
Oh, yeah. We had a couple of margaritas.
You're talking about that stand that's right outside the.
It was that Mexican cantina that you told him about. Okay. Yeah.
Gotcha.
And so we went to that and we ate. And then right after that, we did Turtle Talk with Crush. And Kennedy got picked out of the crowd to like talk to Crush. And it was really adorable. And from that moment on, he was sold. So then Epcot turned out great. We ended up staying through fireworks and it was great. And then we loved Animal Kingdom and we loved Hollywood. And then we finished off with Magic Kingdom again yesterday. And we did a pool day. And that was it. It was awesome.
Very smart to work in a pool day, especially with the kiddos.
Yeah. Although I think next time the pool day will be the last day because they were exhausted after that pool. Matt was exhausted after the pool day.
Was exhausted. Am exhausted. Still exhausted. So we did the mileage. I did the mileage this morning. 75 miles we walked in 6 days.
Wow.
I mean, I work out. I run. I feel like I'm in pretty good shape, decent shape. I'm hurting at the end of every night to the point where she's like, I'm like, you got to have to rub my feet or my calves or something. Like, we're just experiencing pain right now. Painful. And we got to do anything we can do to alleviate this situation. But I will say the experience for the kids, like, so you and Sarah have done Disney a bunch of times, like as kids and as partners and you love the experience. And I got to say, personally, there's a lot of things I loved about it, but what it did for my kids, like, it was irreplaceable. And even though at times I wanted to throw both of them right off the ride because the emotional ups and downs for a kid that goes from all of this just like stimulation to being exhausted and walking and being in the hot. So they're just like, oh my gosh. Oh, and Torres Tube actually asked, did you have all your shirts made? Because we posted shirts every day. No, she made them. She's got this like Cricut machine that like makes them and then she's got to like iron them on. She did each one specific, day specific park wow. specific.
Person specific.
Yeah, it was next level.
32 shirts.
But you got me in trouble because you'd made the one for Epcot. I talked some smack about it. And then people were like,
I was hoping you were going to be excited to be a world traveler, which is why I did world traveler. And then you didn't like it being a world traveler. And then he didn't want to go in all the countries.
Oh, but I did like being a world traveler by the end. That's the whole story. Yeah. By the end of the night, we had walked through a couple. You sent me to Sweden, right? Or Norway.
Norway to Kringla's Bakery for a frozen Viking coffee.
Dude, he liked that.
That changed the whole day. Although I will say the margarita to then the frozen coffee to then a beer and then I think some type of mixed drink.
It'll get you.
I was feeling a little weird by like 7 o'clock.
Oh no, you fell at Hollywood. He fell over at Hollywood. It was great.
That did not get clearance for the podcast. Sorry. Now you got to tell it.
He had a drink at Hollywood. He had an IPA. It was an IPA.
Yeah, I had an IPA way too early in the morning. I didn't eat anything yet.
It was like 11.
And I was thirsty, so I was pounding it.
And he went to lean back on a wall of one of the buildings while there was like a parade passing by. He just bit it the whole way down. I got half of it on video. I'll post it later. It was hysterical. And then he was like blabbering. He couldn't even get it. He was laughing so hard that he fell in front of all these people. It was great.
We did a character breakfast at one spot where I'm pretty sure they gave me a double
mimosa.
Yeah. And dude, I was flying high. The kids were like dancing with Mickey and Daisy. Yeah, they were all there. I was losing it. I was like, I had like a full-blown laughing attack. People probably thought that I was like, anyway, there's a lot of details. Thank you for this appearance. You did a great job on your
first
show.
Thanks for all your recommendations, Joe. We need to meet and have more because we're going back. Because now for anybody who thought he wasn't interested and he wasn't, after day two, after Epcot was over and he was in love with it, then it was, okay, so next year we're going to come. First it was 2 years from now we're going to go. Now it's next year we're going to come. And now he's recruiting family members to go with us. So
it's
thank you.
Thing. Yeah, you're welcome. I'm glad it was awesome. It sounded like a great trip.
Let's get into this Bill stuff. There's a lot to get into. And what's funny about like going on vacation, you probably had this in your over a decade now covering this team. Like you go on like a unplug vacation, which I wasn't completely unplugged, but I wasn't really doing any Bill stuff. And then you come back from it and you're like, oh my gosh, I got to play catch up. And of course we're playing catch up on a day. I'm playing catch up on a day where it's a pretty busy news day. I mean, the Stephon Diggs thing, it happens. We get a little bit of the details we'll go over, but really this is something that we were expecting. I don't know if we were expecting it to happen this soon after talking to Brandon Bean. We heard from him down in the Alderman's meetings, but let's go to your first reaction. You hear the news today. This is something that we've been talking about for weeks, but what was your reaction?
Yeah, I mean, it seemed like it was kind of a necessary evil here because when you have a star receiver on your roster and he's getting paid less than Robbie Anderson, it's probably not in your best interest to kind of let that sit around a while, especially with Tyreek Hill moving up to $30 million a year, Devontae Adams moving up to $28 million a year. And this offseason, there have been five receivers that have moved into the $20 million plus plateau. Those are two of them. And I mean, the other three aren't like super remarkable. Chris Godwin is a really good player, but like, you know, Stephon Diggs is probably better than him. DJ Moore is another one who got into the 20s and he's an ascending player, but he's not there to the grand degree that Diggs is. And then Mike Williams got popped into the $20 million a year club. So when you have those three guys moving into this echelon, and then you see what's coming up, like AJ Brown, DK Metcalf, Debo Samuel, Terry McLaurin, Cooper Kupp, who still has 2 years to go on his deal, Justin Jefferson, who could get resigned next offseason, and he's going to sign a huge contract whenever he does. Mm-hmm. You have all of these kind of things kind of going into it. The Bills almost had to beat the rush a little bit. And that's why I thought it was smart to do so now, if you were committed to doing so. It was either one way or the other. Just either move on from him, trade it, get some assets back, or re-sign him. Because you couldn't really go one way or the other. You needed to keep him happy in such a crucial year. But because they did, now it brings up some other questions about what he's going to be like 3-4 years in his contract when he's in his age 31, age 32 season. But those are worries in the distance. Now it's a matter of making sure everything in 2022 is ready to go and for them to put their best foot forward to winning a Super Bowl, because that's what it's ultimately about.
I didn't get any sense in Florida from Brandon Bean that there was any intention from the Bills side other than keeping Diggs here long term. You know, things happen. Sometimes negotiations happen and things get a little bit wonky as you kind of get into, you know, the numbers conversations. But I thought that probably, you know, they find a way to get an agreement done, and the agreement comes in at $70 million guaranteed dollars. You know, you look at the initial numbers that kind of push the length of the deal over $100 million and the average annual, I think at about $24, $25 million, which comes in under Tyreek Hill. You know, you look at some of the other contracts, the financials are what they are. You knew you were going to have to pay to get this guy here. But I think that the more and more you peel back the layers, it basically turns into a 3-year contract. And I think that they're comfortable with him at that number and what he's done and what he's meant in the building. Immediate projections, though, because I think that that's where you naturally go with the player now that, you know, for all intents and purposes, I mean, they're saying that, you know, they both sides want him to retire as a Bill. That remains to be seen. We'll see what happens in 32, 33, those years. What are your expectations of Diggs now going into next season? Do you feel like there's room for growth? His role in the offense with an ascending player alongside him in Gabriel Davis, how does that impact him? How do you see this all working in the immediate future and, you know, over those 3 years where he's going to be making a lot of money now?
Yeah, that's a fair point, because we saw him really jump out to a huge season in his first year here. And then last year, it was still super productive, but it almost felt like he was missing at times. I mean, the AFC divisional round is a prime example of that. Like, yeah, he caught that 2-point conversion, but the rest of the game, not really anywhere, not really a part of the whole game plan. I'm expecting that things might look a little bit differently with the offense next year, and it could in turn help how the Bills operate with Diggs. I mean, Gabriel Davis is a huge piece to the equation, no doubt. I mean, he, as long as he continues on his trajectory, he is going to be the best second receiver that they've had alongside Stephon Diggs. I mean, Beasley's more of a slot guy, but that outside to outside element, it just was never really there with John Brown in Diggs' first year. Last year, Sanders was solid for the first 5-6 games, but then all the attention went right back to Diggs. And now we're seeing Davis kind of ascend. So as long as he continues his growth, that's an element to it. But I also think the sneaky thing here, and I've been monitoring this as we're going, there's no way to substantiate this until we see it with our eyes in games and everything like that. But it almost feels like to me some of their offseason maneuvers has led this to become a potential more of a threat to run operation where, you know, they go and sign OJ Howard. And that obviously teases more two tight end looks. And down the stretch of the season, they were so much better when they were running those two tight end sets more frequently, whether it be with Knox and Reggie Gilliam or Knox and Tommy Doyle. Like they were really starting to get things working when Devin Singletary started to become a bit more effective. And that's when the whole offense kind of turned. So I kind of wonder if that element to it, where it takes the pressure off, it removes the two high safety as much because they saw a lot of it last year, and then allows the Bills offense to grow that way and let the passing offense get back on track. So it's kind of a convoluted answer, but I think there's potential for him to get back to where he was, but in a weird way, they kind of have to depend on the run to do it, if that makes sense.
I like it. And we'll talk a little bit about it later on, but one of the first big draft pieces you put out was the mock draft where you had the Bills taking.
People still won't let me lie for that one.
But honestly, like the exercise of it is so important. Like when I first saw that you had that as the Bills pick, the first inclination is, man, does running back at 25 just taste horrible in my mouth? But the more you let it marinate and the more you think about, like, you know, it's hard to put this on a guy like Breece Hall, but like the measurables are insanely similar to Jonathan Taylor. And that was one of the first thing that kind of flipped into my mind when I started reading it. We were down in the combine and thinking about, all right, who are the kind of game changing, like elite potential running backs here? And that's one of the guys that you're going to talk about maybe in that echelon. And it's tough. Jonathan Taylor is probably a guy that you see come in and have that kind of impact in 2 years, you know, once a decade, maybe, but the measurables are there and he could have, you know, Breece Hall, if he's able to kind of be that dynamic runner, you brought up a lot of good points in the story. I don't know where I was going. We could probably just kind of veer off track here because this is really interesting. I kind of came around on the idea. Now, I think you get a little bit creative with how you do it. Maybe you're willing to move back 4 or 5 spots. I can't remember specifically now that I'm thinking about it if the Colts did that or not, but they got Jonathan Taylor in the second round. And I know that there was a lot of late first round buzz on him during his draft year. At the end of the day, if he becomes what he's going to become, and I'm sure you've looked at the film, the one thing that you've written about quite a bit, and listen, on the film stuff, I really do go to you for a lot of that stuff. There could be a potential change in how the Bills operate in the run game now that Aaron Cromer is the offensive line coach. And I think it started with the types of people that they're looking to bring in. I think Roger Saffold is a perfect example of that, a guy that could set the tone in the run game. They might be, you know, employing some different scheme here going forward in the run game.
Yeah, totally. I think, well, one of my favorite metrics to kind of track as we go through the offseason process to see any things that are similar. The way that they've approached the offensive line this offseason has effectively utilized more athletic profiles of these starting 5 linemen. And I use the metric relative athletic score, and it's RAS.football, where they go through it with historical data based on workouts of draft years, and they assign a score from 1 to 10 on how they relate to other players at their position. And, you know, it brings a lot into it, the 40 time, their height, weight, length, their agility scores, their composite strength scores, and it yields this one number. And the one thing that stood out is that in the past, the Bills have kind of gone for these big power guys that haven't really had the top athletic scores. But recently, you look at what they have now as their projected starting 5, it's like 8.5 and above. And Deion Dawkins is the lowest one, and he got drafted way back in 2017 before they had this philosophy. But Mitch Morse is in the 9s. Spencer Brown is a 10. Roger Saffold as a guard was in the 9s, I think around 9.5. Ryan Bates is a little over 9.5. So there's clearly a push here to get a bit more athletic. And the only thing in my brain that could justify that is if they're trying to do a lot more movement with their offensive line, whether it be with zone blocking schemes, pin and pull, which Mitch Morse is really good at. And that's when he's at his best in the run game. And honestly, I think for them, bringing in Aaron Cromer, who most recently worked in that zone blocking scheme. And then there's also this little facet of it. In McDermott's first year as head coach, his offensive coordinator hire was Rick Dennison, who wanted to employ the zone run scheme, but they just weren't equipped to do it because they were coming off the power run game with Rex Ryan and LeSean McCoy as their main guy. But the power blocking was really the way they went about it. And so they kind of switched their philosophy mid-season to become more productive as a running team. I think McDermott, being a defensive mind, has always been kind of fascinated by the zone scheme. And this is my guess here, because it is so difficult to defend against. Mm-hmm. So in having all of these different elements moving along the sides as moving along in zone and being able to get to the second level easily and getting out in front of blockers, I think for them, having that ability to press a defense that way in their mind can only help the passing offense as well. So to do that, going back to the running back point, you need the right guy. You need a patient runner. You need someone who can explode through the running lane. And Singletary is good, but he doesn't have that explosiveness, even though he dropped all that weight, reformed his body, and did a really great job last year. But he's not that guy, and he's also on the final year of his deal. So there's a part to it that makes sense. And trust me, I was like you last year. I was like, first round running back, no way at all. I'm totally against it philosophically, theoretically, everything like that. But this year, I think there's a little bit more credence to it because of how common too high safety looks became in the NFL last year. And I think there's a potential market to exploit by utilizing a late first, not early first, a late first pick on a running back, getting them on a cost-controlled four-year deal, having the option for a fifth year where you know you are controlling them, and that fifth year being the lowest total of any fifth-year option at any other position without having to commit an entire second contract to the player where the wheels really start to fall off with these running backs. I think there's a fair bit of logic to doing that if you feel comfortable enough in wanting to become a more dynamic and versatile offense.
There's a few things from Brandon Bean, and I guess by association, Sean McDermott, that have always stuck out to me during the build about the philosophy of what they want to be, right? And they've leaned so heavily into the passing game in 2020 and kind of evolved a little bit. But, you know, certain things, you know, over the course of time, last year, I think it was Brandon Bean talking about, you know, if he likes a running back in the first round, he won't be shy about drafting one there. I remember when they first signed Brian Daboll to be the offensive coordinator, one of the first things he said about him was how impressed he was with him going back to the drawing board and studying offensive line play and the running game with Dante Scarnecchia out in New England. Like, this has been part of, you know, the process. They love what they have in the quarterback. They love what they have in the weapons around him. But I think that they also want to preserve Josh Allen. And that's another thing, part of this. The less he runs or has to run or feels like he has to run, if there's another element of the run game that's having a lot of success, I feel like that they'll be happy with that as an offense, knowing what they have now on the defensive side of the ball, particularly after signing Von Miller.
Yeah, I think the Allen point is a great one. The idea that he has to be both the leading runner and thrower is not sustainable over time. And they depended on it last year and the previous 2 years, really, because of how dynamic it made their offense. And I'm not saying to remove it completely, because Josh is still going to be Josh every once and again and lower his shoulder and try and muscle through somebody. That's just who he is. And, you know, probably in the future, it's going to get him in trouble by missing a game or two, because, you know, it came close to it against Tampa Bay late in the game there. But I think for them, they want to minimize that as much as possible. And, you know, potentially if they were to invest in a running back that is more suited to what they're trying to run, then that could help Allen stay upright a bit more, make them a bit more unpredictable on offense. I think that's when they really struggled last year, Matt, when that Jacksonville game rings to mind more than anything, because Jacksonville just sat in too high for a lot of the game. Sometimes they went cover three, but, you know, mostly they were just saying, okay, you are not going to do anything down the field. Prove to us you can beat us underneath. And the Bills just couldn't move the ball because they were too predictable. And it wasn't until kind of that Tampa Bay game where the light went on and they started to work in more of these two tight end sets that I keep referring to, but it was kind of the catalyst where teams couldn't just say, okay, they're in 11 personnel. Okay, they're in 10 personnel. Odds are it's going to be a throw. But, you know that even if it is going to be a throw, there's probably not going to be anyone other than the five offensive linemen protecting Josh Allen. And you know exactly what you're getting. So all of these different elements to it add into them wanting to be a bit more all over the place for a defense. And that's, I think, for McDermott and what he saw at the end of the year with the not so subtle comments about how the offense was going and what he liked about the offense down the stretch of the season, then I think there's a lot to be learned from what they want to do moving forward.
I think a big part of the reason that the Bills were so comfortable paying Stephon Diggs is not only what he's meant to Josh Allen, but the continuity has been really affected this offseason. I mean, listen, there's a lot of intrigue around the combination of Ken Dorsey and Joe Brady. And I think that the potential there and adding OJ Howard and the potential, we've already talked a little bit about it. You've covered it a little bit, is the two tight end possibilities now with the personnel that they have. And that's even before we get to the draft. It's all interesting stuff. But I think when push comes to shove, most cases outside of the Kansas City game, when Gabriel Davis was the one that went off, Josh Allen relies on Stephon Diggs. So I think for that pairing to be in place for the next, you know, foreseeable future, that's what I think the Bills are paying for more than anything else. Not to mention, you know, what Stephon Diggs has meant in the building. Everybody who talks, I mean, if you saw the clips of Emmanuel Sanders on Good Morning Football this morning talking about his experience with Diggs in Buffalo, I mean, that's not the stuff you just say, you know, to fake it. That's the stuff where I always got the impression that Sanders was really impressed with Diggs, and everybody else you talk to in that building is really impressed with Diggs. I wanted to pose a question because obviously Tyreek Hill signed his big deal. Davante Adams went and got traded to the Raiders, but Hill specifically in 2028 at the perceived end of both of these contracts for Diggs and Hill, which team will look back and is more likely to regret the move that they made by giving this big contract? Will it be the Bills with Diggs, or will it be Miami with Hill?
Yeah, that's a super compelling question. There's obviously no way of knowing, but I'm inclined to say Diggs projects better into his 30s than Tyreek Hill does, because a lot of times when you have speed based receivers, when it goes, it's gone. We saw it with John Brown a couple of years ago where, you know, he had a great 2019 season and he was their top guy. And it's like, oh, they have John Brown and they just added Stephon Diggs to it. Look at this dynamic duo. And then Brown was toast in 2020. But I mean, that's not his fault. It's just kind of how it goes. When the speed is gone, then you're just not as dynamic getting separation. You're not as dynamic getting out of your breaks. And even though Brown was still a good route runner, he depended a lot on that speed to get separation. Hill is obviously an athletic freak, and is probably one of the, if not still the fastest receivers in the NFL. But he's sneaking up there in age right now. I think he's turning 28, or he's already turned 28. And, you know, maybe gets like 2, 3, maybe 4 more years of this elite speed production. But it is difficult to know when that might start to wane a bit. Diggs, on the other hand, to me, the way that he wins on the underneath routes, because that's really his calling card. It's all about his route setup, his technical savvy for all of it, how he just completely fools defenders at times in one-on-one coverage, how he's able to use the defenders' body positioning against them to gain separation, regardless of the route, and reading the defense the way that he does. He will lose some separation as he gets older, but it's not like he's this deep threat dependent upon needing that speed to be able to get down the field. This is a great contested catch receiver. This is someone who rarely drops passes, which Tyreek Hill drops a ton of passes, by the way. And it's also a technician of the position. And to me, that projects more favorably moving forward. Now, will he be the same guy 4 years from now? Probably not, just because it's tough to. But I do think there's a chance that he is able to outproduce Tyreek Hill the later it gets on into their contracts.
And I think right now, with what we have to work with, the quarterbacks that both of these guys have, I mean, Tyreek Hill is taking a significant jump down in terms of the talent that he's playing with. So that's, of course, what he's working with now. So if you're just taking that into account, you're probably sitting there like, yeah, well, I mean, Josh Allen, he's going to be good for the, he's just entering his prime, really, right? Here's the thing, though. It's hard to project past this year at what the Miami Dolphins quarterback situation is going to be. Tua's got a season, maybe less, to show them enough after the kind of talent that they've now put around him. But here's the thing. All the things that you just mentioned about Tyreek Hill and the fact that they're kind of on a ticking clock now with the effectiveness of his game, not only do the Dolphins have to figure out if Tua is the guy, they have to find another guy and figure out quick if that guy's the guy to really maximize the impact of Tyreek Hill in this offense. And listen, I think from a schematic standpoint, there's a lot of potential for what Mike McDaniel can do with Jalen Waddle and Tyreek Hill. I mean, there just is. It doesn't matter who the quarterback is, just from a talent on the field, like those two players, they're probably going to get the ball in their hands and have a chance to make plays. But even if it's not Tua, even if they have to kind of find another way, they got to find a way quickly.
Yeah, I'm with you. I'm a little bit more optimistic about Tua, I think, than a lot of people are. I remember watching him on film before the Bills games. I mean, obviously he got knocked out in that first Bills game, and it was kind of a moot point, and he couldn't really do anything past that because he was out of the game. But I remember watching him, I believe it was the Patriots game the first week, and I'm like, okay, I see where this is at. And then as the season kind of went along, and when they played Miami later in the year, I went back to some previous games of film, and I'm like, this guy can make some really good throws. It seemed like the difficult thing was when within structure, he's so dynamic. The one thing he has to work on is when things get out of structure. But I think who he has coming in Mike McDaniel, and being as well trained and being able to kind of surround an offense around a quarterback to help them succeed the way that the Niners did with Jimmy G last. I mean, it wasn't perfect with Jimmy G, but they still made it to the NFC Championship game right, with a guy who's probably, you know, somewhere between the 14th to 24th best quarterback in the league. Mm-hmm. 14th is probably kind. I mean, Tua, he's got good skills, and he's got really good throwing. He can throw the ball with anticipation really well. His placement is great when he has the time to do it. I don't know. I'm kind of bullish on his fit with Waddle and Tyreek Hill in 2022. And I think Miami could make some noise and get to the playoffs next year and, you know, maybe even compete to win a game in the playoffs. I don't mind their team at all, what they've done this offseason. Mm-hmm.
They're going to be better. And yeah, they've been good for the last two seasons. So I'm expecting a good Miami Dolphins team.
Shout, a Buffalo Football Podcast, hosted by Matt Parrino and Ryan Talbot.
We probably should have let up or put this a little bit higher in the show. Listen, the Diggs deal happens. It's something that people, I think, were expecting. So the wow factor of it wears off pretty quickly. And as in all things sports, it's always about like what comes next. And you know, obviously a lot of noise around Jordan Poyer right now. Just find out today, he's now going to be represented by Drew Rosenhaus, the powerhouse super sports agent that usually enters the mix when a player wants to be better compensated for their efforts. Jordan Poyer, coming off of an all-pro season, his wife Rachel Bush, very, very vocal on social media today, tweeting stuff, deleting stuff, tweeting more stuff. The gist of it is, he's coming off the best season of his career. It was an all-pro season. You could probably pick your holes in it if you want. But in his eyes, one of the best safeties in the league. He's not getting any younger, 31 years old. Seeing money going, getting handed out all around him. Josh Allen gets the big extension. Stephon Diggs now. Von Miller gets signed for big money. Maybe Jordan Poyer. Maybe Micah Hyde sitting back being like, we've been the good soldiers. We've taken, you know, money or contracts that maybe a little bit less than we probably could have gotten on the open market. And time is starting to tick and maybe they want to get paid now. So how does this all come together? Is there any room for potentially a Jordan Poyer extension, new deal, if you will? Do the Bills want to go that route? I have some thoughts. Let's talk this out.
Yeah. I think this is a multi-layered conversation because it depends on what the Bills value above all else. And they have a certain amount of decisions that they have to make ahead of the 2023 season. I know that makes no difference to this year, but this year they really didn't have to make any hard decisions in terms of who they had to let go. Like Harrison Phillips was a nice player for them, but they felt like they probably have about the same or a little bit better than him with the guys that they brought in. Levi Wallace, you know, another player that they probably would have wanted to have back. But since he's not here, they haven't really been urgently trying to replace him. So
let me jump in for a second.
Well,
how much did they want Levi Wallace back? I've gotten to thinking about this recently because
I read the piece that Ryan put together about how Levi came to his decision. And I'm like, my takeaway from that was, the Bills were in on it and they would have been fine to take him at that price.
Right. But my question maybe better should have been phrased better. Should they want him back?
Yeah. I mean, I don't think it matters to them as much. I think, and this is another side conversation that we're going to have to talk out, is I just don't know that there is as much urgency from the Bills front office in getting a second cornerback to pair with Trey White than what's out there. They just have not prioritized it at all since Brandon Bean came into play. Think about who has represented their cornerback moves outside of Tre'Davious White. What do we have? Sharice Wright, Philip Gaines, Levi Wallace, Dane Jackson, who is a seventh round guy. Kevin Johnson, Josh Norman, who is on his last legs of his career. This has not been a priority for them because they've had that great safety play. And I would argue that, you know, investing in a long-term safety would make more sense than a second cornerback. But that's another topic for another day. Back to like the Poyer thing, they have a certain amount of decisions that they have to make for next offseason because of who is coming up in contracts. Stephon Diggs was one that they already answered. So that takes away cap dollars next year. And there's already a bunch of cap dollars taken away from, you know, Von Miller's contract going up, Matt Milano's cap hit going up again, and they can't really push that down too much farther. Josh Allen obviously ballooning to $39 million. So now you're sitting in a situation where Jordan Poyer, Tremaine Edmonds, and Dawson Knox are all going to be free agents next year. So what do you do? Are you going to be able to choose all three? Maybe. Is it fiscally responsible? Is it cap responsible to continue to pay everybody and not let anyone hit the open market? Probably not. So for me, I tend to think, all right, what does it boil down to? Probably if you had to choose for two to potentially go, it would be Edmonds or Jordan Poyer because they would cost you the most, right? Mm-hmm. So then it becomes a philosophical question. And I know a lot of people are out on Tremaine Edmonds. I get it. The team likes him more than a lot of people out there. So it comes down to a philosophical debate. Do you invest in an age 25 linebacker in Tremaine Edmonds or an age 32 safety in Jordan Poyer? What means more to you moving forward? And is there an opportunity to exploit Jordan Poyer having the best season of his career and getting all these accolades and potentially trying to move him if he's not happy? These are things to think about.
I think Jordan Poyer is super important to what they do, right?
Sure.
I think what they ask him to do, like they talk so much about everything that's on Tremaine Edmonds' plate in terms of running the defense, covering, doing all that kind of stuff. But I think what they asked Jordan Poyer to do, you could probably pound for pound stack that up against anybody else in their defense. He plays in the box. He plays some deep stuff. He covers. He blitzes. He tackles. He does all those kinds of things. To your point, though, investing long term based on the result, the immediate results, as big of a fan as I am for what Jordan Poyer does, as much as I was an advocate for Levi Wallace I thought he was better than a lot of the time the credit that he got. Mm-hmm. The Bills are coming off two playoff exits where the defense didn't get the job done. So do you change things now that you get before? Now we've been talking for what, 3-4 years about getting a premier pass rusher. They have the pass rusher now. Are you almost kind of hoping, let's do whatever we can to get this iteration of the defense, no matter what happens at cornerback two, to your point, maybe it's not as big of a deal as fans make it. Seeing what this defense looks like with Von Miller, the safeties back there, and however you got to figure that out, whether it's extensions or whatever else, do that, go all in on 2022 and then figure it out later? Or have you seen enough in the playoff games to where you think that there are some bigger identity type changes that need to be made?
Yeah. I mean, I think everything that they've done this year is an all in move for 2022. And that's a big part of how they're structuring this whole thing. There's a bunch of 1 year contracts in there. There's a bunch of a lot of older players that they're bringing in with to chase this illustrious Super Bowl ring. But it really depends on what they view to be important moving forward. I don't know that it's necessarily like there's a smoking gun from the past playoff exits or anything like that. I think it's just they ran into a buzzsaw of an offense and mm-hmm. they needed to win a shootout and they didn't get it done because they couldn't close out 13 seconds. I think that's what it boils down to more than anything. And there were some schematic things there too that should have been better. So it's not totally players' faults. Levi Wallace was put in an awful position on that one play with Travis Kelce. So I don't think there's a legitimately necessary thing that they have to address. I do think that the idea of taking a player that can cover a tight end in a sub package role in the interim is fascinating to me, because that's a lot of the things that kind of gave him trouble. Travis Kelce just continues to give them nightmares every time mm-hmm. they play him. Mm-hmm. So, that's why I wonder if you can find someone, and this is a tease to what I kind of wrote about today. If you can find someone who has the length, the fluidity, the physicality that can match up with that player in that, big nickel role in the interim that projects into a vitally important starting lineup position past 2022. Now that's a compelling argument to make. Now I'm of course talking about Kyle Hamilton, who is a safety prospect out of Notre Dame. And the initial response to that idea was like, look, they don't need a safety. They have Poyer, they have Hyde, but Poyer and Hyde are both entering their age 31 season. As we pointed out, Poyer's a free agent, might not be happy, switched agents, which is usually a sign that he wants to get paid more. Mm-hmm. And my initial read, especially with the Bills and how they operate, is if they wanted to get something done and they thought the value met what the player is asking for, then they would get it done. Mm-hmm. But that hasn't happened. And something went awry to where Jordan Poyer felt like he needed new representation. Now, the rest of it would just be guesswork, and I don't want to get into all that. But I do think there is something to the fact that nothing has happened on that front just yet. And I wonder what it means moving forward for these two sides. I think it's very logical to wonder what it means moving forward.
This is something that we've kind of been talking about here as well. The financial ramifications as you start to pay people, reallocating that money and maybe dipping back into the draft pool. I think the Hamilton point that you bring up is really interesting, and I want to dive a little bit into something specific about him. Mm-hmm. But, reading your story, the idea behind it is something that, and thanks, Jeff, for the comment, is something similar to what Carolina did with Sean McDermott there when they drafted Shaq Thompson. You can talk a little mm-hmm. bit about that. But it's also interesting to me the way that the draft narratives work. Like Kyle Hamilton, when we get into Combine, right? Coming up to the Combine, you're listening to podcasts, you're listening to the draft experts. You guys have a good one over at The Athletic, Dane Brugler. The narrative is on this guy, he might be the best player in the draft. If he played any other position, if we were talking about any other position, he's the first guy off the board because he's just that good. He's a hybrid type of player. He can do multiple things, the physical traits, all the way that he plays, all that stuff is really good. And then as we kind of move along the draft process, right, starts to dip down and dip down. The numbers aren't great, whatever people are kind of finding. And we don't really know inside buildings where that draft trajectory began. Maybe he never was a top five pick. Maybe he was always a top five pick and we're hearing something different now and it hasn't changed in buildings at all. It's hard to know. Another interesting person too, that I think if he's in range could be a really interesting fit. I don't know how much he necessarily fits scheme wise to his own defense, but I think that's interesting too in its own right with a cornerback, because guys like Levi Wallace, who played a lot of press in college, I feel like you kind of learn to play in a zone no matter what you do anyway. But, you know, I'd leave that more for you. Derek Stingley from LSU, he's a guy that coming into the draft process, his stock was way down. He wasn't going to test. People were talking about him maybe being even a fringe first round pick. Then all of a sudden he runs a super fast 40. Interviews are starting to roll in. And all of a sudden you got Ryan Clark coming out today saying that he thinks he's the best player in the draft. And boom, is he shooting back up mock draft boards across the country. It's just a really fascinating
time. It's a machine.
Yes. It's just crazy to watch it all.
Yeah. Going to the Hamilton thing, I get where that's coming from. I think what we're now seeing is more of just an adjustment to maybe where it's always been as opposed to what it was previously. Because when the whole process begins, you try to identify the top talent out there. But the flaw to it is they can still have talent, but that doesn't mean it pairs with where they're going to get selected in the draft for a multitude of other reasons. Like you pointed out, positional importance. Safety is not important, as important, I should say, to a lot of teams out there. And then you factor in some like athletic hangups. Not every team is going to want a safety who ran close to a 4.6 and he ran a 4.59 at the NFL combine. But Matt, as we always know, beauty is in the eye of the beholder. And the Bills, quite frankly, have shown throughout their past, they do not give a crap about either of those things.
Right.
They believe safety is super important to them. The first two moves Sean McDermott made was signing Jordan Poyer and Micah Hyde back in 2017. And they probably can't believe it's worked out as well as it has over the length of McDermott being the head coach. But it has, and it's been a strength for them. It's why they've been able to get by at cornerback too, and it's probably why they'll continue to do so in 2022. So knowing that they value the position highly, it's almost reminiscent to me of like the Tremaine Edmonds thing, right? Because Tremaine Edmonds was just this complete, you know, I kind of cringe at the use of this word, but like, people have described Kyle Hamilton as a unicorn. I don't even know what that means. He's a human being. Okay. but you,
he's got a horn, Joe. He's got
right,
one horn
right here. But Edmonds was kind of along the same lines. Like he was a linebacker, but super tall, just ridiculous length. Just an absolute, athletic freak for what you usually get in the position. Mm-hmm. And that is something that Bean gravitates to, like a fly or a moth to a flame, a fly to a zapper, or everything like that. That's just who he is. He loves those traits and being able to mold those traits, and he did so with their quarterback. The other part to this is the 40 time. If you go back and look at the draft year 40 times of the four players the Bills have on their roster right now at safety, Jordan Poyer, Micah Hyde, Jaquan Johnson, Damar Hamlin, they are in the range of somewhere between 4.54 to 4.69. It doesn't matter. They believe that as long as you have instincts, range, and playmaking ability, that you can play safety in their system. So to me, it could present an opportunity to where, and this is Bean to a T, right? Like he's aggressive when he sees a value falling down the board. And if he believes this guy is potentially the best player in the draft, I could completely see him moving up. And the spot that I kind of highlighted as maybe, hey, this might be the highest they might go is 7, just because of his relationship with Joe Shane. And I think that would be a safe spot to secure him. And yeah, that might be a little early for safety, but not when it's as important to the Bills as that. And especially not as if Jordan Poyer is going through all this stuff and, you know, you don't know if he's going to be back next year. I think there's a legitimate case to be made to where Bean says, you know what? We think this is an impact player. We think this is a potential all pro. Let's jump up and get this guy so no one else does.
I'm looking over the depth chart, and I have a bunch of like, you know, things that I'm looking at and questions, obviously, in the interior of the offensive line. I thought Ryan Bates was really good last year, but, you know, do the Bills pencil him as a starter? Right now, I almost feel like they have to, unless they're opening up the competition back again for Cody Ford. Roger Saffold's a good player. He's a little bit older. He's a little bit banged up. So there's questions in the interior. You look at cornerback number two. I think slot wide receiver is super interesting, the way that they've attacked that, bringing in Jamison Crowder. We'll probably talk about all of that stuff a ton, and maybe we'll do that later in the offseason. But I guess my question is two part. what do you think is the biggest remaining question mark or hole on the depth chart? Not punter, Joe. Okay. Let's not end this thing with punter palooza.
Come on.
Wait for training camp. We don't even have a second punter yet. Talk about.
We will. By the time the draft is done, we will.
And yes or no, Jordan Poyer on the Bills roster in 2022.
Ooh, that's a spicy one to end it. I'm going to go a little bit off the board because I'm sure everyone's screaming corner. It's corner two. Say corner two. No, I'm not going to say that. I'm going to go with right defensive end. While you were in Disney, I was away in a bunker watching every snap Von Miller took last year. Uh-huh. And one of my biggest takeaways is I thought he was far more dynamic rushing from the left side than he was the right. And the inherent problem with that is if they utilize him out there, Greg Rousseau has not taken a single snap on the right side. He might've in training camp, did not do it a single time in a game last year. Mm-hmm. So then if you're using Von Miller on the left side, what's going on the right? Are you using Bookie Basham? Are you trying to put Greg Rousseau over there? Are you hoping AJ Epinesa breaks through? Are you hoping Shaq Lawson does so on a veteran minimum contract? So what exactly is the plan there on pass rushing downs? Or maybe are you looking at three defensive tackles with Von Miller? I'm just very curious to see how that whole thing kind of goes. So that's what I'll go with for that. As for Jordan Poyer, I don't know. I want to say that he will be here. Because of how important the season is to them coming up. But they are also not going to get to a point where they're going to push forward a value just because the player is upset. Eventually, you have to say, from an organizational standpoint, enough is enough. Like, we can't get you to this point because that is not the value that we assign. And that's sometimes caused them to lose a player in free agency, like the Harrison Phillips thing. You know, I think he even said it after the fact that the Bills valued him lower than put a value on him that's lower than what he ultimately accepted to go to the Vikings. Mm-hmm. So if that value does not align with what Poyer and Drew Rosenhaus believe their value to be, then move on. It's tough. It's going to be difficult. But it also might be an opportunity to trade that player and accrue something that maybe you wouldn't have been able to get this time last year because he's still a really good player in the NFL. Mm-hmm. So I'm kind of couching it one way or the other, but I could honestly see a situation where both results could come to fruition.
The Jordan Poyer thing is interesting. I want to bring up Scott's question here. He's a regular for the show. The Poyer thing is interesting because I view him in the building as one of McDermott's guys, right? One of the guys that gets he combines the ability, like the high level ability with the, you know, proven track record of getting the message across to other guys, right? Which, you know, player driven leadership is important. He's been an Iron Man for them. He's missed only two games in the last 5 years. So availability, which is so key. All of the pieces of this for me, the more and more I think about it, the more I think I just can't envision a scenario where he's not here. But we could be on the road, Joe, to like a holdout, as crazy as that is to say. Poyer and the fact that he's taken all of these, you know, player friendly contracts or team friendly contracts. You know, the gist of the comments coming out from Rachel Bush are that, listen, he's taken less to be a team guy for years, and this is his opportunity to cash in. That's the gist of what I'm getting from all of her comments, and comments that have not just started over this last week here. These are comments that have been coming out from the camp for a while now. Mm-hmm. And listen, it's hard to disagree with them. I mean, this is the year. This is the time coming off the year that he just had, whether or not you want to say he's among the top five safeties in the league. He was named a first team all pro. That's the negotiating power that he has. And he's going to probably try to use it now. That's what the Drew Rosenhaus move says to me. So that's the piece of it that, man, how do they get past that point, right? The butting heads of it, the way that, you know, to figure that out. There's a lot of people in here saying, trust the process. Brandon Bean has done crazier things than what working with a guy that they've had a really good relationship with over the years, what that's going to be. So anyway, long story short, it's going to be really interesting to see how this plays out and how it has an impact on a very like positive spring and summer. This could be something that looms because, you know, mini camps right around the corner. Well, what's going to happen there?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. What, I mean, it's super interesting. And I don't at all fault Jordan Poyer for wanting to maximize his worth. I mean, this might be his last bite at the apple here because of where he is in his career. So I don't fault him for wanting to get paid commensurate to what he believes he is deserved or that he is owed. But that said, that doesn't mean that the Bills are going to just, you know, roll out whatever that the player wants, because that becomes a slippery slope. And if the demands are weightier than what you are willing to give, at some point you have to say, no, we can't do that. We're out. And so that's why it's very compelling. I think the looming part of this potentially hovering over their heads is a very good one. Because, you know, whatever it was, 12 hours ago when Stephon Diggs resigned and it seemed like all was well in Bills land before this whole Jordan Poyer thing kind of began, it seemed like they have removed all the variables, that every potential pitfall that they could have had was taken care of in terms of contracts, getting players to be a star-studded starting lineup, every little thing. But And it really pointed to the fact of taking care of Diggs now to make sure that it does not become an issue when they get to off-season workouts in a couple of weeks and then the start of OTAs in the month of May. But now they quite possibly could be looking at it with someone who was a captain of the team this past year. And I just wonder, because this is a good negotiating window now, because if you are planning to do something and trade him away, this is the ideal time to do it, right before the draft. So they've got some thinking to do, and they need to figure out if these values can align. And if they can't, then see what you can get. It's a cold business, but sometimes you have to be cold.
If you're another team, how do you view Hyde and Poyer?
Yeah.
Because for me, from another team, like Bill Belichick has always just raved about him, but I can't remember a single time he's talked about either of them without mentioning the other guy's name. Mm-hmm. And I wonder if because of that they've been billed and branded as this tandem, that you'd almost be worried. I feel like buyer beware. Am I going to pay all this money and draft capital for a safety and only be getting one half of the dynamic duo? And it might not work in that new setup if you don't have that other guy, just because of how much their success is based, they've said it themselves, how much it's based on their ability to communicate. They don't even think about it anymore at this point. And a lot of times they're out there and they may not even need a coach. Like they could coach it themselves. They know the system so well.
Yeah. It's a fair concern. I will say that it all depends on what you're looking for. If you're looking for an in the box safety who has instincts like Jordan Poyer does, then he's probably going to be successful wherever he goes. If you're trying to take him out of position and have him be more of a deep middle, that's, he can do it, but he's not like, that's not where he's at his ideal. It's not where at his peak. Mostly you would like him, you know, pinching down, being able to help support the run, you know, pick up players and coverage across the middle of the field, things like that. But it is at least a wonder. However, I think the locker room element and the leadership element to it could definitely help influence a team that is trying to establish something that has a need at safety, that has the potential salary flexibility to do something like this. You know, the team that continues to come to my mind, and it's not just because Joe Shane and Brian
did it. I was just going to say it before you mentioned it.
It's the Giants. Like I was just reading my coworker, Dan Duggan, who does a great job covering the Giants for us. Like, they are bare at safety. They got nothing. And they have the 5th and 7th overall pick, and they probably want another kick at the can in 2023, if I had to guess. So
do you want James Bradbury back in a deal, or do you want just the draft capital?
I would rather go and get what if they believe strongly in one of these top tier guys, like let's say a Kyle Hamilton or a cornerback too, just to throw it out there, then go get that guy this year because he can help you. Whereas you can kind of get by next year and what you hope to be the 30th, 31st, 32nd overall pick in 2023 and ship that away along with Poyer to move up to be able to do this. But it almost seems like a logical destination for him. So I don't know if they're going to trade him. I really don't. I think it's in the realm of possibilities. I think it's also in the realm of possibilities that they give him a short-term extension through to match Micah Hyde's deal. But they can't keep everyone every single year. I know right. this. I know the cap is fake.
And I'm not sure that Poyer's going to be into that.
Right.
I think he might want more.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, he sees Von Miller. He sees Stephon Diggs signing well into their 30s. Why wouldn't you at that point? Right. You would say, why not me? What's wrong with me? I've been a part of this puzzle for 5 years. Why not me? And I think he's totally justified in thinking that. But I think there has to be somewhere of a meeting point between what you believe you are worth and what the NFL believes you are worth. Eventually, you're going to get it from somewhere because the level of desperation around NFL teams differ from franchise to franchise based on where they are in their build. So you're probably going to be able to find that somewhere if you are a good commodity. But the one thing teams and I guess people have to be careful of with long-term contracts is they're more projection than reward. Like Jordan Poyer was great last year. He's been really good for them over the past several years. How much longer can he do that? Like how much, where's that fall off point? We talked about it with Tyreek Hill and Stephon Diggs. Where's that fall off point when he's getting in, when you're paying him to on his new deal, pick it up in age 32 season? How much longer can that go at a high level? These are legitimate conversations that the Bills have to have about it.
We're going to get out of here. So 30 seconds on this.
I don't know if I'm capable of that.
Okay. I don't want to put you in any box you're uncomfortable with, but Jerry Hughes, is the door closed and your concerns about right defensive end, is the answer on the roster?
I think part of the idea of it. It's interesting you brought up Jerry Hughes because that's the person I brought up in the Von Miller piece, because in my mind, I'm like, okay, who could be a solid rotational, you know, obvious pass rushing down specialist that can come in and give you good reps from one time to the next that might be in on coming to Buffalo for a year. I mean, hell, Jerry Hughes, his market has fallen completely flat. They might have more cap space because of the Diggs deal, maybe to sign a cornerback. Maybe they might have a little bit more room. We don't have the details yet, but yeah, I could absolutely see that. And to answer your question, I don't know if the right end is on the roster. I don't know if maybe they're going to try and put Von Miller over there, because what the Rams did last year is because they had two guys who are at their best rushing from the left and Floyd and Miller. And so they kind of split it up. They eventually pushed Miller over there more often than Floyd, but they split it up and Miller was still good from the right side, but he was dynamic from the left. Mm. And so I wonder how they're going to play it. And I don't know if that right end is on the roster. I think they would have to hope that one of Epinesa, Lawson or Basham step up. And I don't know if I could bank on that.
Joe Biscaglia from The Athletic.
Hey,
joining us tonight. So thank you so much, my friend. I appreciate it. Let everybody know where they can find your work. You got a bunch of stuff out right now. I'm sure you got something in the pipeline coming out pretty soon. Let them know where they can find you.
Yeah, you can find me over at theathletic.com. You can read any of my bloviated takes over there, usually on the draft, usually long-winded. Usually I try to be as different as possible, but within reason. That's just kind of my shtick. So you can read all over that over at The Athletic, and then you can listen to the podcast, The Buffalo Beat, wherever you find them, whether it be Apple Podcasts, Spotify, what have you. So yeah, find me all there.
There you go, everybody. Maybe Ryan will be back next week. I'm not sure. I saw one Facebook commenter saying, LOL, Ryan isn't here to carry Matt this week. And you're right. But guess what? Joe B was here to carry me. And I appreciate that. For Joe Biscaglia from The Athletic, I'm Matt Parrino, Syracuse.com. We will see you next week. Enjoy your week, everybody. More Bill stuff, I'm sure. News dropping any minute.
Shout, a Buffalo Football Podcast, hosted by Matt Parrino and Ryan Talbot.